kind of left talk, but it's not really there. And go on the Nation cruise if you don't believe me. You know, they have a fundraising cruise. If you don't believe, Catherine Pollitt will.
Do they do TED talks?
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do mindfulness, TED talks, and all that other
podcasts.
Corporate speak that we hate. I'm sure they grow their business. I'm sure they turn nouns into verbs and all that. Anyway, here is.
They're very impactful.
Very impactful and meaningful and deliberate in their lives and their lifestyle, and they do compost. Which, by the way, composting just attracts rats. So just stop it immediately. It attracts all sorts of animals. Don't compost. It's a big lie.
Yeah, go pick at Home
go
Depot.
Go read. This article by Derek Jensen called "Forget Shorter Showers," and then we'll talk. Because the way to solve environmental problems that are crucially need to be solved, horrible disaster of climate change and so on, you can only do that in a mass international way that capitalism is completely not only unsuited for but hostile towards. That's one reason you should become a socialist immediately, because we need an international planned economy to create a sustainable economy that can't be based on short-term maximization of profit. It has to be based on human need, including the needs of the environment. That is completely out. That's not going to happen under capitalism. It's not going to happen. So become a socialist, a revolutionary socialist. But anyway, here's an article that we're going to talk about that will hopefully add to your interest in that. Oh, quote, "Why are so many young voters falling for old socialists?" Now, I don't like that title. And I don't,
May, December.
I don't blame Sarah because editors are idiots, capitalist editors of capitalist
some
publications.
Some enchanted evening.
Yeah, makes it all individualistic. What she means is, why are so many young voters, why say voters, so many young people are interested in socialism? This is really what this is about, although she also makes it individualistic and talks about Corbyn, talks about Sanders, which I think is a big mistake. Sanders isn't really a socialist, but yeah, there's a perception he is, so you could maybe include that with the right qualifications, which he doesn't. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the communist-backed candidate who, thanks to support from young people, surged in the polls ahead of the first round's presidential elections, and he's 65 years old.
What was that about, communist-backed?
Yeah, Mélenchon, he got, I think she quotes later on what he got.
Socialist-backed, too, wasn't
he? Yeah, he had the Socialist Party did not like him, but left-wingers liked him, and the Communist Party
Gauche
Révolutionnaire, part of Critique for International, supported Mélenchon and his stitched-together party, France Insoumise, and France Unbowed, or whatever you want to say that. But I'm trying to find, I think she gave the numbers that he got in that election.
It was
brilliant. He got like 20%. It was like, if you had added the other left-wing candidates.
I was going to say it wasn't enough to get into the second round.
Yes, correct. It wasn't enough. But if you added the 20% that Mélenchon got, and there were two smaller parties, the Nouveau Parti Anticapitaliste, the new anti-capitalist party, which is now about 10 years old, what they got, 2-3% or something, and then another left-wing group, I think it was, I forget the name of it. Anyway, if you added the two smaller left-wing parties, plus Mélenchon, you would have had more votes than Le Pen, and it would have been a race between Macron and Mélenchon, and that would have been interesting. Mélenchon could have won. And instead,
Would that have been similar to Bernie and Trump?
Everyone says yes. I would be a minority report on that, and I would say no. I would say because Mélenchon is really a left winger, as is Corbyn. Sanders is not. Mm-hmm. I think Sanders would have reined in his left populist rhetoric. I think on imperialism, Sanders is horrible.
I do too.
And so I think it would have been a different.
That's what
killed
him
off for me. Different character. It would have had a different character, I think. And also, I think then the media would have gone after him more. I don't think Sanders would have won. My thing is, a Sanders versus Trump, I think Trump would have won. Now that goes against, I think, probably what the opinion is in Socialist Alternative. I think that goes against a lot of people's opinions, and that's truly my personal opinion, sort of minority report on that. But back to this article, June 16th, Sarah Lander, "Why are so many young voters falling for old socialists?" And we are retitling that, "Why are so many young people interested in socialism?" There's some good stats and a couple good comments among a lot of problems. But here we go. Meanwhile, people my age, I'm 29, are more in need of a robust leftist platform than ever. The post-Cold War capitalist order has failed us. across Europe and the United States, millennials are worse off than their parents were and are too poor to start new families. In the United States, they are loaded with college debt or far less likely to be employed without a college degree and are engaged in precarious and non-unionized labor. These are all points we made many times.
What was that about the post-war has failed us? The post-war?
Post-war capitalism. Post-war, how does she say it? Cold War. The post-Cold War capitalist order has failed us. Yeah, she could just say capitalism has failed us, but yeah.
No, I just wanted to make sure she wasn't blaming the post-war people.
Nope. Let's see.
For leaving it not as good for them.
She then says, there's nothing inherently radical about youth, but our politics have been shaped by an era of financial crisis and government complicity. Especially since 2008, we have seen corporations take our families' homes, exploit our medical debt, and cost us our jobs. We have seen governments impose brutal austerity to please bankers. The capitalists didn't do it by accident. They did it for profit, and they did it for profit, and they invested that profit in our political parties. I love that phrase, those phrases, those sentences. I would just take out "our." They're not our political parties. The Democratic Party and Republican Party is not ours.
Parties.
Yeah. For many of us, capitalism is something to fear, not celebrate. And our enemy is on Wall Street and in the city of London. Because we came to political consciousness after 1989, we're not instinctively freaked out by socialism. Now, I'm way before 1989. I'm not freaked out by socialism. But, and maybe we could trade notes here, Tom. I was thoroughly brainwashed against anything to do with socialism or communism in my working class neighborhood with so many people in Vietnam. However, I also have to say, nobody took the time to explain what socialism or communism was. So it was just the words were used as bugaboos, as devils. And maybe that was good, because when I finally got into college and started to read socialism, which was after I'd read a lot of anarchist stuff, when I started to read socialism, it made perfect sense to me. Its analysis, its demands, its tactics, everything, just a lot of it just, you know, made a lot of sense to me. So in a way,
very encouraging to think that the human beings can develop their understanding of how to deal with the situation they find themselves in and make it better on a scientific basis.
Well, here's one of the irony. Exactly. Here's one of the ironies on a more emotive level, I'll say, but I think it's valid. I think psychological studies would back this up. So here we are in America, where political consciousness is extremely low. A big part of that is because the Democratic Party is seen as some sort of alternative, even by some left-wingers, and that creates a low level of working-class consciousness. But it's also the lack of unions, the lack of education in unions, the lack of a mass left. There's many reasons why working-class consciousness is so pitifully low in the United States, and people will talk about themselves as middle-class when they're really working-class. People will talk about themselves as voters like this instead of workers, consumers instead of workers.
You know, massive power.
Denial. Yeah, I can choose toothpaste A over toothpaste B made by the same company. Yay. Anyway, so people really have a low consciousness about the fact that they are workers and the implications from that. But here's an example, right? So I grow up, I'm hit over the head with this hammer from the media, from my family, from everyone around me about quote-unquote communism. The word socialism not used as much, but communism, socialism. But like I said, never any analysis. Always just, it's bad. Stay away from it. You know, it's horrible. They're horrible, right? And that makes an impact for a while. And then as I start to rebel in various adolescent ways and anarchistic ways against all the crap I see happening in everywhere, my school, my neighborhood, everywhere, then I'm starting to, like, whether I know or not, search around for something else on the left, whether I know it or not, whether I'm aware of it or not. I kind of benefited from the fact that the propaganda against it was so crude, and that I could discover those ideas without a filter or any kind of, you know, just that crude. I had to weigh up the ideas to the crude propaganda. The ideas won. The reality of what I saw being in a union and so on, and in a working class neighborhood, won out over the propaganda that seemed written by people that didn't understand. And even if it came from my family, it didn't make sense because, and this is the point, that maybe an original point, maybe I should become a sociologist or something. Maybe it's not original. So
planning has to do a little bit with sociology, I think.
Well, that's not where I was going.
Sociology has something to offer.
I was going for something else. All right, so what happens when you're in a working class family? Well, you're taught a lot about, consciously and unconsciously, about family. You know, and I don't mean in a way the right wing uses that as a political club to do things that are anti-family. I mean, you're taught that you have to sacrifice for your family. You know, like if you start making money as a kid when you're going out to work, your parents might demand some of that money to survive with. That's what happened with me. You know, I wasn't controlling my money when I was working as a teenager. Or just, you know, a million different things that you're taught to be. I can't do this because someone needs a ride, or I have to do this because someone needs to get to work. Everything revolves around work, of course. And you sacrifice time and effort to get people to work or to pick someone up. There were so many times where I waited with my father, because we only had one car at certain points, to pick up my mother from work. So we would drive, I don't know how many miles, from where we lived to where my mother worked, a lot of miles, and then sit and wait. We got there early or something. We'd sit there and wait, or she had to work late. We'd sit there in this car in not so nice neighborhood of Schenectady, you know, sleeping or whatever, waiting for my mother to get out of work. So it's a sacrifice making with our time for my mother. It's a million different things, right? What, you go grocery shopping, what does everyone like to eat? So in other words, altruistic behavior, self-sacrifice is a thread of your living. You're living for other people, essentially. Your parents are living for their children, etc. That's part of the way that's real human nature. It's not the misreading of Darwin where everyone's a competitor and a vicious thing and selfish. Human nature is incredibly altruistic and incredibly self-sacrificing and incredibly social. Otherwise, we wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have survived this long. That's the reality. So if you're told every day, communism bad, and then you start to read about communism and socialism, it's about sharing, it's about everybody works and then you share that out, it's about everyone needs everyone else to survive, to have a decent economy and the reality of capitalism being exploitation of collective labor to make profits for individuals at the top,
and the workers are not pack animals,
right? Everything doesn't add up then. Right? It doesn't add up to your experience at a visceral level. So even if you can't understand everything about Marxism or something, or you can't immediately grasp it all, or it doesn't make a total sense, there's some basic truths about it. You know, like all history, if you understand, is all previous history is the history of class struggle. That what he meant by that was recorded history, or, you know, class societies, but still. And you start reading about slave size, all that makes perfect sense, you know? And you're like, yeah, we had to struggle too, you know? That's it just becomes the propaganda fails, you know? So I'm pre-1989, but I, like millions of others, were able to become socialists. And actually, there was an uptick in interest in socialism, of course. Maybe you could speak to this in the 60s and 70s, you know?
No, 50s.
Late 60s.
50s. Jeff, you're looking at a guy who just turned 69.
No, but you were
in
college in the 60s. But I
think about this because in the Socialist Alternative newspaper, there's a regular column,
we have time for that, we're going to get to one. And, why I became a socialist.
It's always good to keep in mind and try to think back, well, how was it? Because I came from an upper middle, not upper middle class, middle class family. My dad was a doctor in town. And I didn't really think it out because that's something you can't really pass on to your kid, like a factory owner can pass a factory to a kid. So I probably would have ended up scrabbling, but I moved away early when I went in the service. But it was long before that was... I didn't have the ability, but I had some kind of moral feeling or conscience about it, even at a very early age when I saw things that were completely, to me, hard to explain. But I didn't have a context. Like the time I managed to grind bubble gum into the new carpet in the living room of a tiny little house where my playmate and a friend down the street lived, whose mother was staying home to take care of the family, and whose father repaired meters at the electric company, at the power company. And I couldn't understand at the time why she was so upset when she discovered that a new carpet area, a place they had just carpeted, I had basically more or less ruined that. And she was very upset and in tears. And I went away thinking, I didn't do anything all that wrong.
Right, right, right.
But I had. And when I sat in the car, as the dad would take us to school on days that would be like in the winter, five below zero in my Midwest, the cold winters. And he would be trying to teach his son, my friend, Kent, how to drive. And it was a stick shift. And Kent would drive, but it'd grind the gears. And I didn't understand, why did the dad get so upset and make such an emphasis? Well, much later, it occurs to me that if the transmission drops out of the one car in the family, how are you going to replace that old car that you keep having to repair?
Exactly.
So the material differences were apparent kind of to my sense, or maybe the universal childhood sense of right, fair and unfair. Let's say fair and unfair.
Well, that reminds me of part of what I was explaining earlier, but I didn't bring it out explicitly, is that, so also think about this incongruity. So, we both grew up in the post-war upswing, right? And that helped even working class people, especially white working class people. The not helped is the wrong word, but the living standards increased due to the high rate of unionization, due to this threat of the Soviet Union, the U.S. capitalists having that fear of unions and radical groups like the Communist Party put into them in the 30s and 40s. So by the 50s and 60s, they're giving concessions, but they're also making record profits, so it doesn't hurt them. They're still expanding, blah, 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 right? And again, there was a real kind of, unfortunately, racist withholding of certain social benefits like the GI Bill and mortgage subsidies and so on from a lot of and most black people and other people of color. The big wave of immigration hadn't started in earnest yet. So mostly white workers benefited in post-war upswing. But even that, even within that...
Yeah, still Jim Crow up until 65.
Yeah, Jim Crow. So even in that mostly white neighborhoods, there was, like in my neighborhood, mostly white neighborhood, there was still, in the height of the post-war upswing now, we're talking about the 60s, I'm talking about in the 70s, actually, maybe some of this in my mind is the late 70s, which was a different time. That recession, 74, 75, did impact hugely. But let's say some of it at least was the height of the post-war upswing. I remember like walking or running or riding my bike around my neighborhood on a hot summer night. And this is before air conditioning was being widely used. So everyone's got their screens open. And I heard so much arguing, so much domestic violence, really. That it was horrible. It was horrible to me. I remember sometimes stopping my bike in front of a house with having
that
a particularly
was before
bad
mindfulness.
Argument. Yeah. I remember stopping my bike before particularly bad arguments, and you just sit there and listen to see what's going, how far is this going to go, you know? And my own house filled with constant arguing about money, like your anecdote about the rug being ruined. I could multiply that times 1,000, literally. You know, anytime anything that your hours of labor went into, many, many hours of labor that got the slightest scratch on or something, you realize that's going to depreciate that thing or wreck that thing, you know, break a glass. I mean, it becomes a disaster. And of course, some of that was unnecessary venting of all sorts of resentment.
Cumulative.
About humiliation and exploitation and so on. But some of it was real, like, oh, actually, we do need that. Like you said, the cars are like hugely important in the way they've structured transportation in this country, they being the capitalists, that car debt is a huge thing, you know, we don't talk about. And then things have gotten even worse since then, you know. But again, the original point was 89, pre-89, there was a lot of socialists kicking around in the post-war upswing and so on. But yeah, maybe there's more now, especially if you look between, say, compared to the 90s or the 80s, definitely an uptick in socialism. But here's some actual stats I really like about this. Let's see. 2016 poll conducted by Harvard, of all places. Tom and I
know
about Harvard.
They're in the know. They have all the expertise necessary.
51%. Well, they're doing this poll because they're afraid. 51% of Americans between 18 and 29 rejected capitalism. Let me repeat that. A 2016 poll conducted by Harvard, the impeachable source of Harvard, 51%.
I prefer Wikipedia.
51% of Americans between 18 and 29 rejected capitalism, and a third said they supported socialism. A Pew research poll in 2011 showed
Pepe Le Pew.
Showed that the same age bracket, 18 to 29, had more positive views of socialism than capitalism. What socialism, I'm quoting again from the article, what socialism actually means to millennials is in flux, more a falling out with capitalism than an adherence to one specific platform, perhaps. Still within this generation, certain universal programs, single-payer health care, public education, free college, and making the rich pay are just common sense. I agree with that. It's like once. It's like with the problems with Obamacare, ACA, if that's the right acronym or whatever, right initials. The problems with that are legion. It's basically taking public money and throwing it into the maw of the insurance industry. Private corporations making money off sick people. How is that even legal, by the way? So the people making money off sick people, the corporate hospital owners and so on, they're getting money now also from the government and from all these people forced to get health insurance or pay a heavy penalty. People that get, and this could impact us, Tom, people that get health care through unions are going to be taxed more. They delayed that a certain amount. I think it's going to hit us soon, if it hasn't already.
They're doing it behind closed doors, too.
Well, the planning of the new thing. What I'm saying is what already exists. So the shortage of available insurance, the increase in premiums, all these things, that some of which the right wing has used, but it's the truth, against Obamacare. Pharmaceuticals, the cost of medication. It's just really, really horrible. Then there's some good things to it. You can stay on your parents' insurance, warts and all, till you're 26. Insurance companies can't use a pre-existing condition, supposedly, to deny you insurance. I'm sure there's ways around that, et cetera. So there's two or three good things about it. But overall, it's a failed, horrible thing, and they could have obviously put forward single payer. Now, even with all those problems, a certain number of people gained crappy insurance that never had any insurance. And they want to fight for that crappy insurance, and I don't blame them.
There must be some stats about mortality or getting well or getting treatment to prevent mortality under this Obamacare.
I bet there aren't, but there should be.
In England, where they're chipping away at selling it off, and the austerity program where they're putting people off of welfare and telling them they're ready to work, they've now had that in place long enough and have been looking at it long enough that they're actually coming up with statistics. They can't be denied any longer.
Yeah,
even though they do get routinely denied by the Tory cuckoo clocks, but that people have died out of this, have died who never needed these
were
state-sponsored extrajudicial execution.
So the point though is just that people are fighting for bad health care essentially rather than no health care. And by the way, there's still a bunch of people that never quite figured out how this happened. Was it because states opted out or because the law is just so crappy under Obamacare that they're still left tens of millions without health insurance? I guess it's the people that the people that didn't pay the penalty, or they paid the penalty and didn't get the health insurance, because for some people the penalty was less, as odious as it was less than the,
they learned that from their capitalist
it was less than the penalty,
pay the cost of
doing the
penalty
business. Was less, sorry. Anyway,
but they don't get anything for it.
I'm wondering if I should read any more of this thing about the youth liking socialism more. I like this little thing here.
How do they translate it? How do they translate it?
What?
A liking for it. I mean, without falling into the...
That's a good question. That's a good... loosely.
You have to do something.
We're using socialism loosely. There could be all kinds of interpretations. Like Sanders, unfortunately, did a dirty deed going around calling Scandinavia socialist. That's a horrible thing to say. That's going to mislead so many people. Scandinavian countries are capitalist, and they have a lot of problems that we're not told about.
Back in the 60s, they called Stalinist places socialism with a human face. You know, I mean, there's a lot of misinterpretation for decades.
Yeah, So basically, yeah, and she has allusions in Sanders in this article. I'm not getting into, but keeping in mind the definition for socialism can be varied, and what people think doing something means. That's a great point. That could mean voting for Sanders in their mind, being misled about what socialism is, or it could mean, I think for some of them it means does showing up to rallies and good stuff too. You know, I mean, I think that based on anecdotal evidence, and based on something I read that was a well-researched stat that as of about 2 years ago, the average person in college has attended more demonstrations than ever before in history. That would include the 60s. Which really surprised the hell out of me, actually. Now that's maybe going to how you define demonstrations, but
Kent
still.
State or something like days on end of almost everybody protesting.
Right. So it's not that level, obviously, but it's still maybe a protest against racism or a protest against some right winger coming in to speak or something like that. But also, I've been on. Fairly recently, anti-war protests at colleges, protests against tuition fee increases. There's some really good protests happening. Anyway, she says, quote, I encountered many young people. She went to this rally a People's Summit. It was mostly just Democrats and liberals. But she went to that and said, I encountered many young people who found themselves radicalized over the last couple of years and are now joining campaigns in their communities for state-level single-payer health care or for better housing. Those campaigns exist because older campaigners have carried the torch. That's good. Out of all this activity, a next generation of socialist candidates who actually reflect America is almost guaranteed to emerge. I thought that was a good point. For example, where Sharma and Social Alternative made such an impact in Seattle with winning and then getting reelected and winning helping to lead the 15 thing and winning that and so on, there is more of a left-wing presence now in Seattle there with... John Grant running as a Democratic Socialist. He abandoned the Democratic Party.
A woman
and
who's Teresa, running for mayor.
What? Yeah.
I can't think of her name.
I always forget her name, too. Running also, there's a woman running for mayor as a left-winger, and she's created sort of the People's Party to do that. Anyway, we also have this really good article that I think we're going to mainly turn you onto and hope you go read yourself rather than go through it in great detail by Kate Frey. Or Frey. Kate's up in long-term member of Social Alternative up in Maine, and she's cut through the stuff happening up there because you have this crazy right-wing governor, LePage, right? But you also have Democrats up there that could be stopping some of this stuff, and instead they often work with the Republicans. So her point is Maine Democrats sabotage progressive initiatives. And just to give an example, last November, Maine voted on several citizen-sponsored ballot initiatives. Among these were question four, whether to raise Maine's minimum wage from $7.50 an hour to $12 an hour by 2020, and an end to employer exemptions for tipped workers, the so-called tip credit. Another initiative, question five, was on whether to change most Maine elections from a winner-take-all plurality system to ranked choice voting. The impetus and campaign for both these measures came not from the Democrats, but from grassroots organizing and progressive organizations such as the Maine's People Alliance and a group called Ranked Choice Voting. Now, although both initiatives passed... People voted for them, right? Maine Democrats, unfortunately, have since been cooperating with Republicans, not surprisingly, in multiple efforts to block or weaken them. So on May 10th this year, for example, the legislative committee shockingly voted to restore the tip credit by an 11-2 vote, overturning the overwhelming popular vote in favor of question four just 6 months before. In a May 10th article on the Herald Press Herald website, author Kevin Miller called it, quote, a major victory for restaurant owners. Many Democrats joined in this vote, siding with big business to attack the wages of tipped workers. And then ranked choice voting, since it was approved, it's been challenged by both Republicans and Democrats, and recently by the courts, which are composed of Republican Democratic appointees. In 2016, there was a grassroots campaign to impeach Maine's far right-wing, racist, and increasingly unbalanced Governor Paul LePage, who has already closely associated himself with Donald Trump. This move was ultimately blocked by Democrats in the state legislature. So anyway, it's a really well-researched, really good article going over case by case where the Democrats have, defended capitalism, defended corporations worked with the Republicans to stop progressive measures that the people voted for.
They don't really want to mobilize anyone, the Democrats.
They want the easy way out, like with Trump and everything else. They want to...
just every 2 or 4 years, here's your snapshot.
If they don't like Trump, they want to, you know, get some sort of legalistic way to get him out of office rather than mobilizing people. Here's an interesting thing.
That's what they did in Wisconsin with Walker. They had a chance a few years ago to drive out one of the most reactionary, destructive, working class enemies. Scott Walker, the governor of the state of Wisconsin, when almost the whole state was moving, occupying the state house week in, week out, and growing and putting demands on. This is a governor who wanted to roll everything back to the 1920s or even earlier, if he can get away with it.
We have a whole pamphlet about that.
Yeah, and when the state. The state, and here it's not just the Democrats that I wish to critique, but the establishment of labor, the labor tops, you might call them, some people have called them the labor lieutenants of the system or of capitalism even, the ones who basically want to cut a deal with the economic system, and then basically if they get a few extra perks, they consider that they're defending labor. But when almost all of labor was being hit by trying to completely undercut collective bargaining, completely undercut union contracts
in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm. The state went up in arms over it. The working class went up in arms over it, and they wanted to. They demanded. There was a call in many quarters, and we supported that, of a 24-hour or maybe even a 48-hour general strike.
Yeah. Yep.
Just say, look, here's where you get all your value, and we're going to withhold our labor until you listen to our demands and follow through on our demands, not your mealy-mouthed compromise, rotten compromises. And the state Democrats and even these labor tops, actually worked overtime, worked to stop it and to divert it all into a fruitless recall election. You know?
It was where they put up a Democrat again for re-election who had been mayor of Milwaukee and was unpopular
for good reasons.
Conservative policies, conservative, small c, yeah. Conservative. Anyway.
Well, that gets back to what I'm asking. What to do, what do youth who are getting interested in socialism and identifying with it and having no problem understanding its tenets, what is to be done is the question as always, you know.
Join Socialist Alternative.
Yes.
Fight for the things we're fighting for with us. $15 minimum wage in places where it hasn't already happened, which is a lot, most places. Fight for free tuition at public schools, and fight for the increased taxes we're doing in Seattle on the rich. Fight against racist police violence and profiling and so on.
Get out and support every strike and be out there on every picket line.
Through protesting on the streets and so on. Yeah, support unions and their struggles. But do it in an organized, collective way. Individually, you can't do it. Individually, you're just not going to know what to do, where to go, or whatever.
Over and over again.
But also, there is electoral work to be done. Support and be part of campaigns like Ginger Jensen in Minneapolis.
Right.
Independent Socialist Alternative member running as an open socialist, openly as a Social Alternative member to city council.
Who came up out of the Fight for 15
Food worker. For Fight for 15, food worker, I don't know if it was fast food or whatever, but food worker, Ginger Jensen now, then led the 15th Fight for 15 as a member of Social Alternative, now running for city council in Minneapolis. But there are other left-wing candidates, like we're going to get to the, I'll read this last quote from this article by Kate, and I'll touch on some of what we're talking about. Kate writes, in Minneapolis this year, Socialist Alternative is running Ginger Jensen for city council, that's Jentzen, for city council on just such a platform. This refers to an anti-corporate platform mentioned earlier in the article. Leading the way on the fight for a $15 minimum wage and campaigning for bold, affordable housing policies. In Seattle, Socialist Alternative is supporting the left independent campaigns of John Grant and Nikita Oliver, Nikita Oliver running for mayor. John Grant running for city council.
Not Nikita Khrushchev. Nikita, what's her name? her last name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oliver. Nikita Oliver.
Nikita Oliver.
In their challenge to the pro-corporate city establishment, the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, which social terrorists called on to join us in running independent social candidates around the country, have also recently endorsed Grant and Oliver. By the way, I read the ISO in our social organization has endorsed Ginger Jensen's campaign, and That's Socialist cool. Action, I think, even did a fundraiser, like a public fundraiser for the campaign.
She has really good prospects.
Strong independent left campaigns such as Jensen's, Oliver's, and Grant's can begin to lay a foundation for what we really need, for what will really be needed to challenge pro-corporate, pro-capitalist politics in the United States, a new mass party of, by, and for working people. And that is to be found at socialistalternative.org 2017. Anyway, you'll see it on the socialistalternative.org website.
Well, now is the in-between elections and let's say during the summer, because many of these, we're talking about young people getting interested in socialism and they're in school.
Ginger Jensen campaign is off and running, up and running over the summer, though. If you were going to make a point about...
I was just going to say that is
doldrums.
A time
There's
when
There's no doldrums this year.
No, there shouldn't be. There shouldn't be doldrums. It's productive time.
Like even in Worcester, for example, the teachers are going to be doing, I believe they're going to be doing campaigning and protests over the summer because they're without a contract. I mean, there's some summers where, as you've experienced too, where the politics doesn't slow down as much as you think it would because of people going on vacation.
Well,
and stuff.
the 15 an hour movement that was certainly definitely active
in
the summer.
Absolutely,
it's not all just tall ships and crowding into
tall
the
trains. Tall ships. I try
going on board anywhere without some money.
I couldn't help thinking about the tall ships. How many of them were from the slave era? You know, I couldn't help thinking that. So I'm like, you're going to extol the virtues of some frigate from 1812. How much did it? How many slave ships did it protect
That's what
or whatever? I couldn't get over it. You know, and then you know, I think I would go there and say, hey, any of these after 1866? I'll go for the war. They did some
steam
horrible.
Power.
Then you get into imperialism, right? It's like, oh god. Now I can see enjoying the history of the tall ships from a certain angle, but from a certain angle, I just. You know,
it's bread and circuses.
From a certain angle, that would be the whole their complicity.
They're gonna have
their
to pay more
outright,
on the tea because the
outright,
tea the
being
subway.
Part of slavery. Ugh,
yeah, nice. The subway God. Rates continuously go up, and so you get on there. Everything costs more to do, and like we were saying earlier, fees on everything.
Hey, we're gonna switch gears here because we're running out of time. And we say if you were part of our off air conferences that Tom and I have before shows. We have grandiose plans to cover a million subjects, including the Russian Revolution, because it is the it's 2017. It's the 100th year anniversary of the Russian Revolution, the greatest revolution against capitalism ever. It didn't last forever, but for a short time, it did successfully overthrow capitalism and set up a workers' government. It went further than any other battle against capitalism so far, and there will be other battles. The Russian Revolution, contrary to what you're told and what you're brainwashed about, it was extremely democratic and extremely good for working people and caused a movement internationally, which is still being felt. That is still an example of what can happen to capitalism if you're organized well enough. And there's still, even though conditions aren't the same today, there are some real similarities. The system hasn't changed its essence, you know, since then. So... I just want to kind of throw this out in headline form. Maybe we can talk a little bit about whatever catches our fancy here. But this is from a website I would highly encourage you to go to, started by the Committee for Workers International. And it's called, and why don't I have the website on here? Do you know that the Russian website? Not Russian website, but the Russian Revolution website. 1917-2017, I guess is the name of it.
You just Google Russian Revolution 1917-2017 CWI. It'll take you
Try that. Yeah, good. That's very good, yeah. So they don't have the exact address here in front of me. This is where that comes from. A website and Facebook page specifically set up to commemorate the Russian Revolution from a Marxist standpoint, from the standpoint of the Committee for Workers International. So here we go. This is a timeline for June 1917, because we're in June 2017. It's the fifth part of our series on events of 1917. Dates are given in the old-style Julian calendar used in Russia at the time. This was 13 days earlier than the Gregorian calendar adopted by Russia in 1918. So, quote, Russia is on rations. Food supplies to the troops and towns are running low. This is 1917 in Petrograd, Moscow, and other major cities. They're receiving 10% of the grain they need. And the government... Now, remember, this is after the February Revolution, right? So they put in a nominally socialist prime minister, a nominally progressive government, and yet it's decided to continue supporting World War One with troops and things that munitions and so on. It has not done land reform. It has not done all these things that people wanted. That's from the original revolution in February. So the movement building for revolution continues. Yeah, there you go. 10% of the grain they need. The government, a coalition of capitalists and right-wing socialists, has failed to deliver the promises made during the February Revolution. Strikes against factory closures and land seizures by peasants increase. The influence of membership of the Bolshevik Party is growing from 15,000 in the capital in Petrograd at the end of April to 82,000 just in Petrograd by the end of June. Can you imagine? April, May, June. What do you do? How do you even discuss with people? Hey, welcome to the party. Boom. June 1917, early June, former U.S. Secretary of State Elihu Root. I'm going to tell Martha about this person, Martha Root. On an official visit to Petrograd, ramps up pressure on the provisional government to intensify the war. The U.S. Secretary of State puts it bluntly, no war, nor no loans. That's familiar, right? By-elections to the Soviets see gains for the Bolsheviks. Yeah,
the bankers would have said no ownership, no trains.
Yep. By-elections to the Soviets, the workers' councils and the peasants' councils and the military councils, they see gains for the Bolsheviks, now the largest party in the Moscow Soviet with 206 deputies. The Mensheviks, right-wing socialists, have 176. The peasant-based Social Revolutionary Party, 110. The first all-Congress of Soviet workers and soldiers deputies begins in Petrograd. Of the 822 voting delegates, 285 are SRs, 248 Mensheviks, 105 Bolsheviks, and 32 Menshevik internationalists. At the Congress, Lenin calls for measures against bosses who are locking out tens of thousands of workers in an attempt to weaken the movement and derail the revolution. A strike wave erupts among the most exploited, mainly unskilled workers. Also, sailors on the Sevastopol battleship arrest their officers. I like that. You were in the Navy. Did you ever arrest your officers?
No. In fact, the U.S. Navy is second only to the Tsarist Navy in class restriction.
Following a conference of workers' representatives, the Bolsheviks' main newspaper, Pravda, calls for a demonstration on the 10th of June in opposition to the Menshevik and SR coalition with the capitalists and an end to the war. The Central Council of Factory and Shop Committees backs the decision, as does Leon Trotsky's group, the... I can't even say this word. Mesarianci. Sections of workers and soldiers in Petrograd are calling for the seizure of power, but Lenin and Trotsky understand it's too far ahead of the mood in the rest of the country. They maintain the need to win majority support in the Soviets for a socialist alternative. The Petrograd Soviet executive demands the demo is called off. The Bolsheviks argue in defense of the right to peaceful protest. The Mensheviks and SRs get agreement at the All-Russia Congress to ban demonstrations for 3 days. Confronted with this ultimatum, the Bolsheviks decide not to go ahead. The Putilov factory of 40,000 workers and the 1st Machine Gun Regiment reluctantly agree to postpone the action, but only after lengthy discussions with Bolshevik party reps. Next headline, the Mensheviks step up their campaign against the Bolsheviks, falsely claiming they are German government collaborators. The Mensheviks attempt to retake the initiative by calling demonstrations on the 18th. War Minister Alexander Kerensky orders a new military offensive in Galicia. Can you imagine? Central Eastern Europe.
I want to make a
Can
comment you imagine? About Galicia.
Against Austro-Hungarian German forces, stocks and shares rise on the Paris Bourse. The offensive begins on the 18th, eventually causing 400,000 Russian casualties, 150,000 of those killed.
Yeah, I was just going to say that World War One. Some of the worst battles were the beginning before trench warfare was introduced, because it was just basically giant groups of foot soldiers hurled against other giant troops, armies of foot soldiers, with artillery decimating on both sides of that. So the giant battles, Galicia being the part of it's really the Ukraine now. They're talking about the territory known as Ukraine now, and it was where the flashpoint between the Germans and the Austrians and the Russians. And the Russians won a couple of big battles at first, and because they had more artillery, there just were more of them. And then the Austrians won, and Germans won some big battles that were horrendous. So we're talking about millions of people by the end of the first year of the war, before things kind of settled down into the stagnating.
They were adding aerial bombardment. They were adding tanks. They were adding mustard. Poisonous gases.
They were all for it. Gas. Let's put science to work on it.
The day of action backfires on the Mensheviks, and SR is turning into mass support for the Bolsheviks. Up to 500,000 march in Petrograd, demanding, quote, all power to the Soviets, and, quote, down with the offensive, end quote. Similar protests take place in Moscow, Kiev, Kharkov, and elsewhere. Anarchists in the capital attack prisons, freeing several hundred inmates. Next headline, the Petrograd Soviet passes a resolution greeting the Russian army's initial advances by 472 votes to 271 with 39 abstentions. The size of the opposition marks a leftward shift, with Bolsheviks, Menshevik internationalists, and left-wing SR members now making up two-fifths of the Soviet in Petrograd, the most important city. These, by the way, if you just tune in, are headlines commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution in June 1917. What was happening in Russia in between the February and October revolutions? The machine gun regiment refused to fight for imperialist war aims. Many soldiers are arrested. Others step up pressure on the Bolsheviks to seize power. Patriotic demonstrations whipped up by pro-war propaganda lead to scuffles. Far-right groups are formed. The Military League, the Union of Cavaliers of St. George, the Volunteers Division, others make military
and
coup
the Black
plans.
Hand.
Bolshevik newspapers warn the garrisons of the danger of being provoked into premature armed conflict. A conference of representatives of the factory and shop committees, the Central Trade Union Bureau, and more than 70 factories agree to back the Bolsheviks' approach to building the revolutionary movement. See, this is interesting. So a lot of the theme here is some people, well-meaning, let's say, but also not so well-meaning, but some are convinced the time is now. The time is now for revolution. And you actually have to place yourself in the leadership of the Bolsheviks and other organizations that might have supported that, that said, no, it's not. Imagine how, like, you can be then accused of being reactionary and too conservative and blah, blah. You know what I mean? That actually happens a lot in politics. You get involved in left-wing politics, socialist politics. You get, inevitably, and it often comes from a very good place, people with no experience, younger people with no experience, whatever, and they want it done yesterday, you know? Yeah, let's go out and fight the cops, you know, as anti-fascist fighters and so on, you know, without thinking, what are the balance of forces? How will this be seen? What is the purpose, you know, et cetera,
the biggest organizing march in the civil rights era was the poor people's marches in, Atlanta. And one of them was called off, basically, by Martin Luther King, the leader, because there were anarchists at the front of it who were smashing windows and smashing cars and starting fires and things like that.
Yeah.
And it was the marches were so big, the mobilizations were so big, that you couldn't even know that if you were towards the back of the march.
Right.
And it was felt, rightly so, that this was bringing down the hammer on not only on that march and on that giant mobilization, but also intimidating. The hammer would intimidate people from wanting to ever get out and mobilize.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
there's a lot of reasons why when you think tactically, mm-hmm. you put a brake on. That's because you don't want the car to go over a cliff.
It's easy. So it's a lot of times easy to be ultra left. I mean, truly ultra left. Now sometimes that term gets abused for, wanting to do something that. Sometimes the movement is ready for more radical steps, and that's the whole point of having a leadership that is a thinking leadership that's using a methodology like Marxism, but also is accountable, and so on. So sometimes you have to say, okay, in the past we wouldn't support that, but now we do, because the time is necessary for that.
And that's in the history of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah, all that stuff, all those lessons. So anyway, skipping a few things because of time, we're almost out of time. Under Lenin's leadership, backed by Trotsky, the Bolsheviks party program sets it apart from other political groups. Its class struggle policies to fight job losses for the eight-hour day and workers' control win over industrial centers and working-class districts. It openly opposes the military offensive and has important bases of support in the armed forces. Constant vilification of the capitalist press and by establishment politicians reinforces the view that the Bolsheviks are the only ones fighting consistently for the workers, soldiers, and peasants. Their successes have marked them out, however, and counter-revolutionary forces are moving against them with ever more determination. That's the June 1917 news from the front, so to speak.
The ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Those were interesting days.
So now we're going to have to go really shorthand here. here's an article, one of many actually I've read like this, where when you actually analyze the votes, blaming the American working class for Trump is not only misleading, it's just statistically wrong, factually incorrect. So check out ElectionCon 2016. New evidence demolishes the myth of Trump's blue-collar populism, meaning being popular among working-class voters. And I'll just cut to the chase here because of time, where the stats are. And basically we have, and I've read this in other places too. I think I've even read some of it on the air. Trump voters were not more likely to be, okay, support for Trump seen in previous polls is largely concentrated among more affluent Americans. Trump voters were significantly more likely to be older, white, Republican conservatives, a group that has been quite privileged, historically speaking. Trump voters were not more likely to be unemployed compared to non-Trump voters. Income-wise, the single largest group of Trump supporters was comprised of individuals hailing from households earning incomes of more than $100,000 a year, which made up 35% of all his voters. Those earning between $75,000 and $100,000 a year accounted for 19% of Trump voters, meaning that 54% of the president's supporters came from households earning over $75,000 a year. Another 20% of Trump supporters earned between $50,000 to $75,000 a year, putting them over the national median household income, which has long hovered around $50,000. In sum, approximately three-quarters of Trump voters were from households earning more than the national median income, while just one-quarter earned less than the median. So, you should read the article for other angles and arguments on this. It's from counterpunch.org, June 16, 2017, Anthony DiMaggio. And again, that's not the first article I've read about the overwhelming narrative from the corporate media, but also, unfortunately, from some left-wingers and some progressives is, oh, working-class people voted Trump into office. No, actually, the majority did not. When you include non-voters, that's even more clear.
Well, if you look at the primary process, the caucus process, the whole thing is designed to dilute genuine majority viewpoints or accurate reflections of what goes on in the working class.
And then Clinton winning the popular vote. And then also on top of that, people who, I'm sorry, I forgot my train of thought. Clinton winning a popular vote, people that didn't vote, like I already mentioned, there was people just not enthused enough to bother voting or to vote for a Democrat, if you include, and I'm not saying third party voting put Trump into office because it clearly didn't statistically, but it is a factor, and I think it's a good factor. I don't think people should vote for Democrats because someone like Trump is thrown in there, because there's a lot of Trumps out there historically, and there will be more.
Well, look who gets to even decide voting districts and where you can vote.
Oh, horrible gerrymandering.
What are the criteria for allowing you to vote?
Yep. By the way, we wanted to get more into this maybe next time. One of our co-hosts on the show, Social Alternative Radio, which you're listening to, by the way, is Diego. Diego's had experience working in Whole Foods, as we call it, Whole Paycheck, and other nasty names. But as you may have heard from the corporate media, Amazon, the big conglomerate that specializes in delivery services of commodities, not stores. Although they have bought into, ironically, there are Amazon bookstores now, and they're known as undercutting the brick and mortar, as they say it, retail bookstores first and foremost under Amazon. Now they're buying real stores. They just bought Whole Foods, the Whole Foods chain, for $13.7 billion, which is kind of funny because...
Oh, they got it for a song.
Well, John McKay, the CEO of Whole Foods, is one of these capitalists that tries to be ideological and talk about how great capitalism is and the way they do things. And here he is just selling out to the highest bidder. And everyone, there's been some good articles.
But it was a family. He sold the family down the river.
There are some really good articles about how his ideas are full of crap. But anyway... So this scared the other chains, and the reason we're mentioning is because this will impact a lot of people. Amazon will come in, you can bet, and change people. That's already started. If you know anyone that works at Whole Foods, they started out years ago hiring full time. They now just mainly hire part time. They've had layoffs. They had a certain number of days off they've cut into. They discourage people taking sick time. That's where Diego ran into them problems there and so on. And, of course, profits have slowed. because it's just so freaking expensive to go there. I still go there for some targeted organic produce that I can't get elsewhere or can't get as good elsewhere, but I pay crazy money for it, and I make sure I don't buy that much. But I noticed that the tricks that Whole Foods has done is they actually have less range of goods now. I don't know if you ever go there. They got smaller portion sizes, like a lot of other stores are doing, with just everything you can think of. And
meanwhile, portion control, you go to any vending machine in the United States, and you see the same products with less of it in a package, and more cost out of your pocket.
Yep. Well, also, despite the organic stuff, they do stuff to vegetables that's controversial, like waxing of apples. Like you go into Whole Paycheck and you see these apples. There's always got tons of apples, and you're like, apple season was a while ago, and these apples look extremely fresh. Well, some of that's because they're importing from other countries, but some of it is they wax the heck out of these things. So I actually bought apples like a couple weeks ago, even though it was really out of season. I'm not used to doing that. For apples, and they had this pretty firm exterior till you get these little parts that are mushy, and then you eat into it, and there's like parts where the wax didn't take or something, and like it's really not ripe anymore. It's kind of gross. Anyway, we've only got 5 minutes. We did not get to Why I'm a Socialist by Zahid Alvarez in the latest edition of Socialist Alternative. It's great. Why I'm a Socialist. Maybe next time. We did not get to more analysis of the French elections, and we did not get to a really good article I'll turn you on to. By George Martin Brown, called from June 12, 2017, from socialistalternative.org, Fighting the Far Right, Social Strategy and Tactics. It's kind of what Tom and I got into a little bit about what is truly ultra-leftism and what is not.
And what is to be done.
What is to be done. Where is the time for, not going all out versus times where you need to. We didn't get to more on Corbyn and the British elections, still the aftermath, especially in light of Glenfell. So maybe next time we'll get into those things. I also brought a book we didn't have time to get into, but I mentioned it last time, last show. Last show was kind of bookish. Last show was like, I made a big pitch to please read, find time to read. I can't find any time to read. I still find time, a little bit at least. Struggle with me. Mentioned some books I was reading that are quite good. Here's one I added to the list called by Stephen Kinzer, who has Problems of Liberalism, K-I-N-Z-E-R. Used to write for the Boss's Glob, the Boston Globe, and for New York Slime or New York. What is my latest New York Times insult? New York Swine. I call it the New York Swine for the New York Times. Kinzer wrote for these regimes. And he wrote a book more recently. I think it's from 2006. It's 10 years old.
Didn't he write a lot on Central and Latin America?
Yes, very good, Tom. He wrote All the Shah's Men, An American Coup, Roots of Middle East Terror, Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Here's the ones you're thinking of. Bitter Fruit. Untold Story of American Coup in Guatemala. You know a lot about Guatemala, right? And then he also wrote Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. Here's the deal, right? Kinzer wrote this book called Overthrow. This is the one I'm promoting here, not because of he's got any solutions to imperialism or capitalism. He unfortunately accepts them as unassailable, but he does talk about the unfairness, I guess, from a liberal progressive standpoint of America throwing its weight around. So it's Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii, 1959, to Iraq, and Iraq in the 2000s. And he goes through, and of course there are many other imperialist interventions than what he lists, but he goes through some systematically, like Chile, a lot of information, and I kind of recommend this book. I've read it once before, read parts of it, and I'm going back to it now. Stephen Kinzer's Overthrow.
What press?
The other books I was extolling last time. This is Times Books, Henry Holden Company, New York. Well, I don't have them in front of me, but it was that one White Trash about class in America by Nancy Eisenberg, I think is her name. There was this one, The Color of Law, which I'm highly recommending, just came out very, very recently by showing government and corporate policies that led to segregation, that created segregation out of law. It wasn't just white flight or whatever. It was a deliberate strategy to keep whites and blacks, especially, from living together.
Redlining,
and in more so, like actual laws that enforced redlining and laws that took segregated neighborhoods and made them to unsegregated neighborhoods and made them segregated. I mean, it's really, so far, a good book, Color of Money. I think he doesn't get the economic side of it as much as he should, but the legal side is right there. And then what was the other one I was extolling? I can't remember. But anyway, there you go. Read left-wing stuff, read progressive stuff, and use it to organize as a revolutionary socialist. My last words. What are yours, Tom?
Forward to socialism.
Yeah, all right. And thanks for listening, everybody. You've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Hopefully we'll see you in a couple weeks. Go to WMFO.org to listen to the show archived. Go to Fenian Rising. They download some of our shows for...